So there were these people who were publishing Dracula, republishing, you know, the Bram Stoker book. Right, if it's either a chapter a day or a chapter a week or something, and Tumblr have gone mad for this for reasons I don't understand. But in Victorian times, that's how books were written. They were all written chapter by chapter and published in a magazine, well, a chapter a month.
Also, in Victorian times, people used Tumblr. Carry on.
They did. Victorian Tumblr, but then they banned all the shots of ankles and everyone stopped using it. But so...
Howdy ho, everybody, and welcome to Season 3, Episode 47 of Bad Voltage. We hope you're doing very, 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 very well.
A lot of errors.
I'm joined here with my two compadres, Mr. Stuart Ian Langridge.
Correct.
And Mr. Jeremy.
He didn't think of anything, did you?
He didn't think of anything, again.
You thought of, in fact, zero things.
All right, Jeremy Ian Garcia.
Jeremy Ian Garcia, yeah. We can go for that.
Did we actually ever figure out his middle name?
No.
It's still a mystery, isn't it?
No, he has very carefully not told us.
I'm sure it's Beyonce. It's got to be Beyonce.
Hence the hilarity.
Shall I tell you what I think it is? Jeremy Garcia.
Jeremy Garcia Garcia.
Yes, that's what I think his name is.
I'll be right back. Just need to put in a quick passport change.
It's hyphenated.
It's hyphenated. Well, make sure you check the expiration date, just like George Castro.
Wow. That's a couple of people now this has happened to recently. A mate of mine had to get his passport redone. He meant to do it in January, just didn't think about it. And then it turned out that people won't let you travel when you're within 3 or 6 months of it running out. And it's been with the passport office now for like 10, 11 weeks, and it's still not back. So we had to cancel the conference.
Oh, no.
Wow.
I know. And he's like, where's my passport? And they were like, oh, we're backed up because of, I don't know, COVID or something. You're like, you're just a bunch of lazy snipes. Do the passport. So I've checked mine about 6 times and I'm sitting there going, I know mine runs out in 2025. And I checked it a bunch anyway, just on the off chance.
Mine's not that far off from 6 months, actually. I do have to
do it. Do it. Like, get on that soon. Immediately.
Yeah. A friend of mine who lives here in my town. Brilliant guitarist, joined a very well-known metal band as a touring guitarist. Ooh. Just before the pandemic. Yeah.
If I guess, will you tell me?
Yes.
Which means it's not Anthrax or something then.
Not Anthrax.
Am I going to have heard of them?
When I say very well-known...
Right, you mean
I mean partially well-known. Right, to heavy metal people.
I'm assuming the reason I'm allowed to guess is because it's not Megadeth or something.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, actually, I probably shouldn't say who it is because I don't think he wants to share it publicly.
Is it
but anyway,
Baron Carter.
That's what I said.
It's not Baron Carter. No. No, we said touring metal band. and also well known. anyway, no, he joined the band and his first gig was playing a massive festival in Holland just before the pandemic. Pandemic happened. His green card was about to run out. Filed it urgently, and it took 2 years for him to get his green card renewed. Couldn't leave the country.
What?
And had to leave the band. This band is based in the UK.
Wow. No.
Yeah. Poor guy. He's such a lovely guy as well. So, yeah, the moral of this show is check your documentation and submit it early. Everything's backed up. Yeah.
Wow. Well, that's horrific. Oh, no.
Yeah. I felt so bad for him because he's such a good guitarist and such a lovely guy, so... Anyway, all right, let's go on to brighter waters. We are going to do some news today. Mr. Langridge, why don't you start us off with something interesting?
Okay, so a small thing to begin with, just because we've talked about this before and I thought it was interesting. Everything's going to be USB Type-C now. The EU are actually legislating it, finally. So this is everything. I mean, laptops are going to be delayed a bit, but I think a lot of laptops are now, and everyone's planning to be. So by 2024, everything's going to be USB Type-C.
So just to get into the specifics, this means that if you want to sell a device in Europe, it has to have at least one USB port. And is that how it works?
If it's wired, if it does wired charging at all, and it's not something weird. So if it's, they've actually got a list, which is smartphones, tablets, e-readers, earbuds, digital cameras, headphones, headsets, handheld video game consoles, and portable speakers.
All the major stuff, basically.
Yeah. So if you make like some little light up snowman or something, it doesn't have to be USB type C. But if you're doing any kind of semi-standard piece of computer related consumer electronics, it has to be USB type C. Well, and it charges wired. You can make it wireless, and then this doesn't apply. You don't have to add wired charging if you don't have it.
Wow. That's kind of it's kind of amazing.
It's interesting.
They've passed this.
Yeah, I'm curious what you think about any government agency regulating to the point of requiring a very specific protocol on all hardware.
I know, yeah.
I thought it was a good idea the last time it happened. I mean, when we talked about USB Type-C before, I was all against the idea of people pushing for it because most of my devices weren't. But that was like 5 years ago. And since then, you two were both, nah, basically everything we own is USB-C already, which just goes to show you how little I buy consumer hardware. But now, everything I own is USB Type-C with the exception of the iPhone. And Apple will either make it USB Type-C or they'll just supply an adapter. You know? And from my point of view, this sort of thing is a public service because it means that you don't have to have loads of extra cables and e-waste. You know? It's a good thing. It means you can assume a baseline level of stuff, which is good.
It's one of those things. I always find these kinds of news stories fascinating because on one hand, like in this specific instance with USB-C, it makes eminent sense, right?
Yeah.
Like to all the points you just outlined, it does make me feel a bit weird that this bureaucratic organization just can mandate something like that. Because while this instance makes sense, you know, what if something else that didn't make sense and then they mandated
but
that?
It almost seems like this forever sticks us with USB-C, and let me give you my reasoning why. Everything used to be USB. The micro B, terrible. Everyone acknowledged it was terrible. The USB consortium is broken to a level that it never got fixed for years and years and years and years and years, despite everyone agreeing it was terrible. If it was mandated at the time that everything had to have a micro USB port, would Apple have ever done Lightning, which is what lit the fire for USB consortium to actually finally do a thing?
Okay, so that seems like a really good argument if it wasn't for the fact that it was mandated that everything needed a micro USB port, and what Apple did was they put an adapter in the iPhone box. And people built USB-C stuff anyway.
There was an EU mandate that everything had to have a micro USB cable port?
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Because this is what got rid of... Do you remember the things? I've literally got...
I can see Jeremy Googling as we speak.
Yeah, no, it's real.
It's not that he's questioning your bullshit.
No, do you remember the little thing you used to keep in the inside pocket of your coat or in your laptop bag or whatever, where it had 25 different mobile phone connectors on it?
Yep.
I have one with a Bitnami logo on it.
I know. It's the one piece of merchandise that I ever use from a company.
I found it like a week ago. I went, oh my God, here it is in the pocket of this jacket I haven't worn since 2006. But the
reason why that was a popular gadget was because it had USB-C on it.
Yeah.
And everything else only had micro USB.
But the reason they mandated micro USB for charging was precisely to get around the fact that every mobile phone manufacturer just made up their own thing in like 2003 or whatever. And so they said, no, you've got to charge for this. And Apple put, I think the point is that after a while, I don't know whether they repealed it or whether they just stopped enforcing it because everyone was kind of on board anyway.
That mandate was substantially different than this one. That was basically only cell phones, and it was because every cell phone manufacturer had their own janky, proprietary, slightly different shaped charger.
But that's exactly the case with laptops right now. Exactly the case. And on mobile phones, the problem is largely solved. The goal here is not to stop, it's to stop laptop manufacturers inventing their own thing, which they keep doing, but it's also to get people to move on from micro USB to USB-C. And largely, if you're a sensible consumer electronics manufacturer, you're doing this anyway, so there's no need for the mandate. So who objects to this? Not someone who objects to the overreach of government power or some bollocks. Who objects to the fact that people want this?
I'm just suspicious. I'm suspect that we want government regulating specific implementation details in technology. It's more conceptually.
I don't think it's an issue with USB-C per se. I think it's more of the general pattern of governments mandating technology decisions, which, like, to Jeremy's point, technology keeps growing and getting better.
And like I say, we had this before. Yes, it was just for cell phones, but we had it, and what it did was it got people to move on, and then when people brought out USB-C charging cell phones, they didn't get busted by the EU for it. Right? And so I don't see that it's going to stop experimentation. There is nothing stopping you putting an adapter in the box, because that's exactly what Apple did last time, and it's quite possible it's what they'll do this time, because if they switch to USB-C, they obsolete every Lightning connector. This is exactly the same when they went from 30-pin to Lightning, and everyone bitched about the fact that they had a little plug-in thing.
Changing foundational things like this, it turns out, painful and takes years.
Yeah. And part
one of the reasons I'm suspicious of governments regulating it. So
You see, my opinion on that is the other way around. Part of the reason, you sacrifice someone's ability to innovate in connectors, sure, but what it stops a company doing is innovating in connectors and then locking you into some damn connector so all your equipment becomes obsolete when they decide to change.
Yeah, but what if they've mandated that Windows had to be shipped with every machine in Europe? Then Linux would never have happened.
Pretty much did mandate that, dude.
They didn't mandate it. They never mandated that Windows had to run on every machine sold on a computer in Europe.
Sure, the government didn't. Microsoft did. Did it make a difference? No, people built the thing anyway.
I'm not talking about Microsoft. I'm talking about governments.
What difference do you make?
I mean, Microsoft, it's not unexpected that Microsoft want Windows to be shipped in every machine sold.
You're talking about the difference between a de jure and a de facto thing, but it doesn't really matter, does it?
I think it massively matters. Because without turning this into a broader question of the role of governments, in my mind, I see the purpose of governments making sure that where they regulate things are in the interests of, like, you know, the safety and the equity of their citizens, right? Absolutely, you know. But my worry about when they get into, to Jeremy's point about getting into specific implementation details like USB-C, is that the next new thing is going to kind of come along, and generally the way the world works is that the market tends to figure its way out. There's a reason why USB-C has become popular in recent years, is because consumers are generally preferring it. You have specific holdouts like Apple, who've already said that they're going to put USB-C on the iPhone 14, I think it is, right? So to me, the market can figure this stuff out.
I don't know why in laptops ahead of everyone else,
right? And I just don't know why a government needs to mandate this. I'm not sure what the real benefit of this is. I mean, so having people having to have fewer cables doesn't seem like enough of a reason to it for me. If there was a safety issue, like if you put Lightning on a device and it burst into flames, I could understand it, right? But there isn't really a safety issue here. It's more of a convenience matter. That's my only concern. And I just worry that when governments mandate things, it makes it really hard for people to step beyond that and break the stranglehold, right? That's the whole point of open source. Open source was able to break the stranglehold that the industry had us in back in the mid-90s.
Was it?
Yeah. I mean, think back what it was like when we first got into Linux and open source.
Yeah, I remember the only people who used Linux on their desktop were people who used to hang out in pubs and talk about that and nothing else, and nothing has changed. Oh, no, none of us are using it now.
No, I'm talking about, like, look, back then, of course, it was massive, big, proprietary Unix systems on servers and Windows and the desktop. Now, Linux didn't win the Windows desktop world, but it certainly has won the client-side world with Android. And the server is absolutely being won by Linux. So the fact that you had these big, bulky entities out there, open source was able to break through. And I think part of the reason why is because there wasn't any government mandates that said that that you have to run a specific thing.
So just so I understand this, when governments mandated that you had to use open document formats, specifically the open document format, was that a bad thing? I thought we thought that was a good idea. We wanted to break the power of Microsoft Office, and governments mandated ODF.
No.
At no point did anyone say, or no one in our camp, There's no point. Did anyone say that's bad on it because you're preventing people innovating in document formats? What we want people to do is stop bloody innovating.
I think we're talking about two different things, because
I know
I would object against open document format being mandated for literally everybody, but open document format was mandated for government computers, and absolutely it should be mandated because that is an open interchangeable document format. Right, I get that.
With the intention of that spreading out so everyone has to adopt it, right? Don't tell me that.
Well, no, but it would have been like saying you cannot release a Word, any kind of Office suite that didn't support it, which no one ever suggested that.
Right. No one ever suggested that.
Fair enough.
It wasn't you can't sell an Office suite that doesn't support ODF. It was that if you want to be installed on government computers, your Office suite must support ODF, which are two way different things.
I see the obvious intention behind this kind of thing is you make it so everyone is obliged to be able to read this with the intention of making sure that it grows out there in the market. It's not like anyone would have been happy with the idea that there was a government document format and there was an everyone else document format and the two things were different. If the world had ended up like that, that would be rubbish. And no one wants that.
But I remember the reason why there were people advocating for mandating open document format in government is because public money is being used to procure those technology services.
The
view was, it's absolutely the case.
Sure, but that wasn't actually the reason we wanted it to win. It really wasn't. What we wanted was that Microsoft wouldn't be able to just own document formats forever. We wanted open source out there. Sure, we had reasons about government money was what's being spent, but that's not actually what we were asking for.
No, but I'd say two things. One is, has my mindset changed from when I was 19 and now? Fucking of course it has, right? You know? But the second thing is, I don't ever remember, speaking personally, ever having of the view that we should force open document format on people or we should force Linux on people. I think what we were all wanting was to just be able to get into the game, right? And most of the arguments around open document format being mandated within government was to reduce vendor lock-in. And a big chunk of that was because if you have vendor lock-in, then your government is dependent on software that's controlled by a corporation. Right? So I think at least that was my viewpoint. Now other people may have different viewpoints. So
I will say I thought this segment would last minutes.
10 seconds.
Yeah.
I thought
it's
I'd
the
go
classic
hey,
bad voltage formula.
USB type C and you lot will go, good. Next section.
Yes. All right, what's next? Jeremy, do you wanna serve something fresh and hot for us to savor over?
Sure. So there seems to be a little bit of a fracas over here between Firefox and Chrome and some of the browser extension. And I wanted to get your opinion at, because I don't know a lot about this space. So curious if this is just people grousing or if there's an actual technology or culture issue here. So I'm reading from an article that we will link to in the show notes. It says the rupture centers on a feature called web request, commonly used in ad blockers and crucial for any system that looks to block off a domain wholesale. Google has long held security concerns about web request and has worked to cut it out of the most recent extension standard, which is calling Manifest V3. So for a little bit of implementation detail, just so everyone has some context on what this is, since I definitely did not, under the current available specification, which is Manifest V2, browser extensions can use an API feature called Web Request to observe traffic between the browser and a website and to modify or block requests to certain domains. They give an example here that is a very simple, basically put all these URLs into an array, and if there's a match, block the URL. So it says the Web Request feature is powerful and flexible and can be used for both good and bad purposes. Ad blocking extensions use the feature to block incoming and outgoing traffic between certain domains and users' browser. In particular, they block domains that will load ads and stop information from being sent to the browser. And then it says, under the new specification, the blocking version of the web request API has been removed and replaced with an API called declarative net request, which instead of monitoring all data in a network request, the new API forces extension makers to specify rules in advance about how certain types of traffic should be handled, and the extension is able to form a more narrow set of actions when a rule is triggered. And then it notes that AdBlock Plus, a very popular ad blocker, has come out in favor of MV3, although they note that that extension has a financial relationship with Google. So all that said, what's actually going on here, since this is a space you follow closely?
Right. So, This is going to be the Ollie North description of what WebRequest does, right? It's it'll explain what's going on, but don't necessarily try it on a Google Chrome engineer or something.
That seems reasonable.
But from a very high level perspective, the way it works at the moment is if you're writing an extension that wants to affect someone's access to the web, so to do things like ad blocking, for example, you can basically say, run this code on every web request, right? When someone requests a URL, whether that's a page or a thing within that page, like a JavaScript file or an image or whatever, the code in your extension can look at the outgoing request and the response coming back and then do whatever it wants. It can go, right, I'm going to alter the content that's coming back. I'm going to alter the content that's being sent out. I can block it entirely, whatever. Okay. There are good things and bad things about this. The good thing about it is that the code can do whatever you want, so it's very, very flexible. So it gives you the option of not only blocking based on things like the URL, but you can also block based on what's in the content. If you want to write an extension which blocks all pages which contain the word Jono, or which patch in the words Jono's World of Metal at the top of a page, you can do that. Right? That is, and some ad blockers and things do work like that. So, Ghostery, for example, and I believe the FF Privacy Badger do a lot of inspection of the content that's coming back. They're not just a big list of blockable URLs. The downsides with this are two. The first one is that it's quite slow because you have to run some code that's been written by some random bod who built an extension you liked on every single request. Not only is that a bit slow, but it also, if you've got a slow extension installed, it slightly degrades the quality of the web as a whole, right? And the Google people take a partially sensible and partially paternalistic attitude to web performance, in that there's a lot of, we really want the web to offer really, really great performance, which is great, but there's also a little bit of, and if you're not really good at providing web performance, maybe we'll take over a little bit for you to make sure that the web performance is good, even if you're not paying enough attention to it. And that leads to things like AMP,
which we've discussed at length in this very podcast.
But this is not an AMP thing, but it's that mindset of then going, we want the web to be super duper performant. So the way we'll do that is we'll build a thing in which we hoist pages off of newspaper websites onto our own domain and make that really fast, right? Same mentality. The second reason that the web request stuff is a problem is that because you can alter a page, there's nothing stopping you writing an extension which alters the page in ways that you, the user, don't realize it's doing and might not want. If you wanted to write something which injects something into the page which steals your credit card details when you type them in, an extension can do that. Now, when you install an extension, it pops up a thing saying what it's going to do, but a whole bunch of them say it needs access to all of your shit in all of your tabs. And you don't get the option of going no. Well, sorry, that's not true. You do get the option of going no, which is uninstall the extension. But there's no more black and white than that. It's like Android permissions used to be right at the beginning, where it's like, this thing can do all the things. And your only option was, then I won't install the app, right? And things got a bit more granular over time. So it became, this thing wants access to your contacts. Give it a contact that it's allowed. So it asks you every time rather than asking once at install time. Extensions are still very, very much in that grant it all permissions kind of vibe. Plus, you probably wouldn't want an extension to be asking you, do you want to let it fiddle with this web request for every web request you make? Because every page makes like 200. So Google's proposal for the way this should work is what they call declarative net request, which, boiling it down, oversimplifying to a point where our hypothetical Chrome engineer would be quite cross with me for this. In essence, you get to go, here are a list of URLs or URL regular expressions. You can block stuff from that, and that's all you can do. You can no longer do content inspection. You can no longer decide to block this thing if you let through four others from that domain in the last 15 minutes. Well, you basically don't get to run code. That's why it's called declarative net request rather than net request. Now, again, I am massively oversimplifying, But Google's approach is, look, we get... attempting to summarize the vibe I get from Google, which is not what they think the vibe is. The vibe they seem to be projecting is, look, we let you lot have this extremely powerful tool, and what you did with it was buggered up everyone's performance. So now we've decided mostly you can't be trusted. So what we're going to do is we're going to take it away, and we're going to give you a thing which solves 90% of the use case, no problem. And then we're going to work with those of you it doesn't solve to see what we can do about it. But what we're not going to do is let you run arbitrary JavaScript for every request. If you don't like it, you know.
It does seem to me then there is a legitimate security and performance concern that they are addressing. Like, it's not completely made, despite it aligning with their business values in a very direct way. So what is your opinion? This is a good decision and you are supportive, or this is not a good decision?
Google have a notable tendency to think up stuff for how they want the web to change, which has five reasons for it happening, or four reasons for it happening, or whatever, and then they state three of them, and the last one, which is this is great for our business model and not that great for other people's business model, goes unstated, but it kind of seems to be there, right? AMP was like that, Flock was like that, and I don't even blame them for coming up with stuff which is conveniently good for them. It's that they always try to come off like it's an accident. It's like, oh, goodness, is this particularly good for us and not that good for people who aren't us? Crikey, we had no idea. Goodness, well, if we'd realised that, we'd have changed it, but we're a bit too far into the process now. Better get on with it. So, I think on balance, I'd rather have the ability to run the code and take the performance hit. I can see how someone might fall down on the other side of that. It is unfortunate that the people who fall down on the other side of that are the people who get to decide what's in the biggest browser. But they are listening. I mean, this discussion has been going on for years, literally years at this point. Google proposed this some time ago, V3. And there are legitimate reasons to want to do it, as you say, Jeremy. There are legitimate reasons to not want to do it. So the fact that they managed to get Adblock Plus on board, because their model is basically we provide you with a great big list of URLs anyway. That's how their thing works. So they're like, yeah, this is fine for us. You're like, kind of. Ghostry, not so fine with it. And I'll give you another example of something which I found very useful on Android, and I just flat can't do on my iPhone, which is really annoying. And it's for this reason, again. One of the reasons I use the Brave browser as my default on Android is that I can block JavaScript on a per site basis. So what that means is you go to a website and if it, you know, fine, they give you a cookie pop up because you're here or whatever, or they, you know, they scroll a little bit when stuff loads in, that's okay. But sites, if they're obnoxious at me or they give me a cookie pop up where I have to go dig around for the reject button, or if I'm trying to view something and then a video sort of scrolls up from the bottom and covers the text or something, right? You get one chance, and if you spend that one chance, you have sacrificed your permission to run JavaScript on my device. Boom, gone. At that point, no ads for you, right? I just turn off JavaScript on your site, done. I flat cannot do that on my iPhone, and it's really bloody annoying. And I thought, right, I'm going to build a Safari extension to do this. Don't know how. How I even compile this on Ubuntu, but I'll work it out. I'll have a look. And you, and the reason you can't do it is because they've taken away the URL. They've taken away the API that lets you do this. Essentially, the way JavaScript blocking on a per-site basis works is that you have an extension which looks at the site, the data that's coming in, and then injects into it a declaration, no JavaScript in this site. And then the browser just goes, okay, I won't run any of the JavaScript. Done. You can't do that in Safari because the API that lets you inspect a web request and then inject stuff into it has gone away. And they've done that for the same kind of reason that Google have. Their concern is about performance and security. And sure, there are legitimate reasons to not want that. And Safari has never had it, right? Safari has extensions on iOS, which Chrome does not on Android. Firefox does on Android. But This is genuinely infuriating from my point of view, that this was a real feature that I had on Android. I do not have an iOS and I can't get it. Now, some of this is because the Apple browser bad and whatever, but leave that to one side. This is a real effect, which I think would be better for people. If we built a world in which people would just encourage someone's annoying website, just turn off JavaScript on that website, people would stop being annoying pretty quick. Right? So I don't like the fact that Google are increasingly moving from so this is a bit strained, but this to me feels a bit like the argument you were making 5 minutes ago, Jono, that this is Google deciding what's best for you and removing your ability to innovate in what's best, because they go, well, we've already thought up the way you need to do this, and then we've mandated that's all you're allowed to do.
So, very quick question. This one also went longer than I thought it would. So we're on.
I'm sure you weren't expecting a 10-minute without pause for breath explanation of this.
No, I kind of was. You mentioned two specific things: AMP and Flock, both of which were not successful. AMP lasted a little bit longer than Flock did. Both eventually did get rolled back, though. Are you making the argument then by using those two examples that you believe V3 will eventually include something like the original functionality, or did you just happen to use those two examples?
I use them more as examples of overreach than rolled back things.
I think one led to the other, though. So I guess your contention that this overreach will eventually get rolled back?
Don't know. They're examples of paternalism, I suppose. The fact that Google are still discussing this is encouraging on that front, because there's nothing stopping them just going, we're doing it, right? Yeah. Which is what Apple did with Safari. They just went, yeah, you can't have this. Yes. We're not even going to listen to opinions about whether you should have it. So Google could do that, and they aren't doing it. They do seem to want to solve this, but they seem to want to solve it while not giving us the ability to run arbitrary code in a web request. And people are like, that's what we need. Sure, you can keep adding new ways of creating rules which do the thing you want, but then you're making it possible to build ghostery, but not ghostery, the next ghostery.
Got it.
Okay.
You know?
Oh, God. I was going to say, this is the longest we haven't heard Jono's voice in an episode he was in potentially ever, so.
Yeah. Yes. I was doing my hair. Yeah, I don't have a lot to comment here, obviously. Although one thing I did want to say was, Ak, you mentioned that you're using Brave. I would actually like to do...
I was on Android.
On Android.
I still am on iOS, but for a different reason, which I'll explain if you like.
I'd quite like to do a segment on a show about Brave, because I was reading into them. I hadn't really thought about Brave, and I was looking into them like last week, I think it was. Because I thought, oh yeah, that browser, I've never used it myself. I know that obviously the focus on privacy and all the rest of it, but it's interesting how they've got this whole like basic attention token thing.
The reason I moved is not only because I moved to iOS, right?
Right. But I'd like to, I think that's an interesting business model for a company that we should talk about. It's fascinating what they're doing, but I don't know enough about it, and I'm sure you know a lot more about it than I do, Ak, so... Maybe we'll talk about that.
Add it to the planning doc, or we will forget. Because I think it is an interesting topic.
Write it in the list at the top. The thing I use it for at the moment is I can sort of do what I'm talking about, because I have Brave installed and I've just disabled JavaScript in it entirely, which means that if I want to read a thing and it's being annoying, I share it and then share it to Brave and read it there.
Got it.
Oh.
So Google News. Attempting to,
yeah. This is all part of the conversation that we have about this, because that in itself is interesting. We should talk more about that. So
let's change gears here completely. Now I have a little bit of a question for you, Mr. Bacon.
Yes,
as a musician who has produced music where you would ideally, I imagine, someday like to make money, even if it wasn't your main vocation. What one way to do that these days is clearly Spotify, and I thought it was interesting-ish when they really pushed into podcasts, because when they went into podcasting, they went in pretty big, hundreds of millions of dollars into multiple acquisitions. And clearly, if you're listening to podcasts, you are not listening to music. So it's a fundamental step change in their business model and approach. Now they're saying they also want to get heavily into audiobooks, which is, again, not music. So I'm curious, do you see this as Spotify is clearly one of the largest streaming platforms, and especially one of the largest streaming platforms from a player whose main reason for existing is a streaming platform. So like Google has one and Apple has one, but it's part of a broader ecosystem play where Spotify used to, like, all they did was music. So I'm curious what you think of this shift, and if you think this is a signal that a lot of people for a long time said a music streaming service was not a viable business model long term. Is this an acknowledgement of that? Is this something else? Like, curious to just get your overall take on it.
Yeah, it's interesting to me because Spotify specifically is very controversial in the musician community for probably obvious reasons, right? Is that you put your music up there and each stream gets 0.00001 of a penny or something like that.
I don't even think it's that much, man. I think you're like two orders of magnitude out.
You know, for example, with my band, Baron Carter, I use a service called CD Baby, which is a distributor. So I upload the music there, and then CD Baby, I pay them like $80 or whatever, and they distribute it to all of the different networks, Spotify and Apple Music and whatever else. And then I can see inside of CD Baby what my sales are in each of these different areas. And you don't see a lot of Spotify revenue. Now, a lot of musicians grouse and complain about Spotify because they believe it's killed the revenue stream for music, which to a reasonable extent it has. People don't buy CDs anymore, but that's not Spotify's fault. That's the fault of just the internet, right? And everybody complained, everybody complained to about Metallica when they, you know, when they sued Napster. But to be fair to Lars Ulrich, annoying as he is, this was kind of what he was talking about. Basically, what's happened is what Lars Ulrich was worried about. However, the thing that I think a lot of musicians don't reflect is exactly what I'm experiencing right now with my band, Baron Carter, which is when I was in my band in the UK before all of this, the only way to reasonably be successful in music was to get a record deal. So a very small number of people basically dictated what you get to listen to. And you could be a local band and print burn CDs and CDRs and go out to shows and all the rest of it. But now, with a click of a button, I can distribute my music everywhere. And it makes it easier for bands to be able to actually make an impact and to find new audiences. So streaming has been good for that. In my mind, the audiobook thing is probably a way in which is a way in which Spotify can, I imagine it's easier for them to sell an audiobook or to stream an audiobook and have less grief from authors than it is from musicians. Because musicians are just harder done by than authors. Authors make more money than musicians, as on average, I would suspect, because the average amount of money made by musicians is $0. Whereas the average amount of money probably made by the average author is probably going to be, you know, a couple of thousand, maybe, not much.
What?
Yeah.
Why? Is your opinion that the average amount of money made by musicians with a record deal is $0?
No. I think the average amount of money averaging out all musicians on the planet is probably not much above $0.
Yeah, but I think that's the same for people who write things. People with a publishing deal make money, but people with a record deal make money.
If you write a book and have it published, right? So it's available for people. So to do two comparisons here, right? If I was to put out an album and put it onto Spotify and all the networks, right? Or if I was to create self-publish my own book and do it through Kindle Direct Publishing, I believe I'll make more money through Kindle Direct Publishing than I will through money going on these different places.
Oh man, I'm prepared to believe that you believe that.
Believe that you believe that.
Yeah.
I love the energy.
I
am prepared to believe that you believe that.
I don't believe it, but equally, I haven't got any evidence either. In fact, we both have, I would guess, at a conservative estimate, possibly a negative amount of evidence for this. But I think it'd be a really interesting test.
I have evidence.
Do you? By the Lord Harry?
I've written 5 books and I've put out a bunch of albums. I have direct evidence. I've made a lot more money from books than albums. I can tell you that.
You had a publishing deal.
Yeah.
That's not the same thing at all.
And with good publishers too.
Yeah, absolutely, right? I would suggest that you had better publishers by comparison with other publishers than you had a record company by comparison with other record companies.
I don't know how to say this in a way that's going to sound nice, so I'm just going to say it and hope that certain people aren't listening.
Right. So when you said five books, you meant only five books, right?
You don't get a lot of marketing support from publishers.
Hmm.
So what publishers will do is they'll print the book, and like with your book,
they
print it and they make it available to sell online, or they'll send it out to some bookshops. Reasonably, with music, I'm doing the equivalent of that with CD Baby. I'm putting it out there. I just think that people are willing to go out and buy books, and people aren't willing to go out and buy music.
I see. The reason I don't agree with you is, imagine you are the 10th best selling record in the UK in one given week. How many records do you think you sold? I don't know the answer to this, so I'm interested in your opinion. I know it for books.
Such a bad voltage data point to ask a question to which you have no idea what the answer.
You said that with such steely determination, like you were leading to this bright...
And then you're like, yeah, don't even have an order of magnitude guess. Just
The reason I'm asking the question is I do know the answer for books. So it'd be interesting to compare them, but I don't know it for music. That's why, instead of declaring the answer, I'm asking you because you know about music.
I don't know, but what I do know is that you hear these kind of like, I was going to say old wives' tales, but I'm guessing that's pretty politically incorrect. What's the equivalent of an old wives' tale now?
There's this whole class of phrases that I learned when I was a kid, which I'm trying not to say that now. So ignoring all the ones which are just obviously wrong. Things like, I don't have a dog in this fight. It occurred to me like 9 months ago or something that I'm talking about dogs having fights. That's not a particularly nice thing, is it? Maybe I should think of something else to say.
Yeah. And, like saying somebody went off the reservation is, I didn't know this, is... It's obviously racist when you hear it.
How about we just stop saying stuff like that? Good idea. So I agree with you. Not an old wives' tale. A fallacious piece of history, or whatever we call it.
Fallacious piece of history. That fallacious piece of history. So I know that the vast majority of people consume music via streaming. There are some people who buy vinyl and CDs. It's a tiny proportion. So the difference, I think, is that the 10th most popular author in the UK, a reasonable number of those sales will be ebooks, audiobooks, and print books by definition.
Sure, yes. In fact, I would guarantee all of them would be them because there aren't any other ways to get books.
Well, yeah, I mean, there may be streaming book services, I don't know, like Apple Books, I don't know.
Kindle Unlimited or something would be the equivalent.
Yeah.
I don't think Kindle Unlimited is a streaming book service. That would be something more like, so there are these people who are publishing Dracula, republishing, you know, the Bram Stoker book. Right, if it's either a chapter a day or a chapter a week or something, and Tumblr have gone mad for this for reasons I don't understand. But in Victorian times, that's how books were written. They're all written chapter by chapter and published in a magazine, well, a chapter a month.
In Victorian times, people used Tumblr. Carry on.
They did. Victorian Tumblr, but then they banned all the shots of ankles and everyone stopped using it. But So the reason I bring this up is that I am told, and I'd need to actually get better stats for this, but I am told that on a bad week, you can be on the Sunday Times bestseller list, 10th, right, to the bottom of that list. So you're the 10th best-selling book in that in the country for that week, and you might have only sold a couple of hundred copies.
I think that's a fallacious tale of history.
Well, it's a well disappointing number if it's even close to true. I went, oh man, really?
Sounds like an act tale to me.
Having sold books, and going, hey, guess what? Earning out, it only happens to about 50% of people. And look, if you manage to get up to sort of 5 or 10,000, you're doing really well in our game. But then how many records do you sell? If you've got a record deal, but you're not, I don't know, if you're Shed 7 or something. Because in my head, all you hear about is people with platinum. I tried to pick the most obscure band I could think of off the top of my head. I don't know why I picked Shed 7.
Skunk Anansie.
Skunk Anansie. At least we're ever going to get an email for the people in Skunk Anansie or something like that. So that means you don't see that many, and you keep it at people with, you know, gold discs or whatever, but then they're just They are to, you know, you two are to music what Stephen King is to books, right?
Well, it's all relative, isn't it? Like, when I released People Powered, I was really going to have a go at the New York Times bestseller and managed to sell, and it's all based upon the week the book comes out.
You're HarperCollins, right?
Yeah.
Was it HarperCollins?
And, and that week, I thought I was in for a chance. That week, we sold something like just under 3,000 copies that week. And I was like, I might get on the bottom.
I mean, that's not bad.
Not even close. No, not even close.
Really?
Yeah, but it depends on, like, you know, it depends on the week and what books come out. Because obviously, if you've got a week when Hillary Clinton brings that book out, then everybody's buying that. But if you, if it's Richard Simmons, if he brings a book out, then who cares? I don't know if it's still alive. But
I'll tell you what, I would love to, first of all, hear from people listening who know something about this. So if you're in publishing or if you're in music publishing and you have some sense of numbers and whether, I think, you know, you've got full top pro, Stephen King, in bookwriting, Taylor Swift in music. And then you've got a class below that of professionals that their whole job is making music or writing books. And we're primarily talking about fiction here, I think.
Right.
And then you've got a class below that of people who are doing this and they're making money at it, but it's not enough to sustain them. And then you've got a class below that of people who aren't making any money, but they're doing it anyway. They're playing gigs in pubs, or they're just playing guitar with their mates, or they're writing fan fiction on A3 or whatever it's called, rather than trying to get it published. And those four classes, in my head, feel about the same between music and authorship, except for the fact that I can think of loads of rich musicians, and I can think of hardly any rich authors. So...
Yeah, it's, I don't know.
I can't think of anyone who writes books and then smashes up hotels and like flies all over the world on jets. Like, I don't know. Last posted that was Hunter S. Thompson and he's dead. So.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, we'll see what happens. I mean, going back to Spotify, it makes sense to me.
There was a question at the beginning of this, wasn't there?
I suspect they will just go into anything audio. And potentially, I mean, they clearly want to be like a major platform for media, but they are going to have to figure out this royalties issue. The problem with it is it's so prevalent. And like when I look at the data between all the networks that Baron Carter's on, like the vast majority of it is people listening on Spotify. Like the rest is not even close. Like not even.
Is it when you say the vast majority? I'm sure that's the vast majority of listens and like listener minutes or whatever. Is it the vast majority of money?
No, the money. There's more money elsewhere,
and I think that's the point. The question is whether you want more people listening or you want fewer, more lucrative people to listen.
Yeah,
because there's only one game in audiobooks, right? Audible is the only game in town. They didn't used to be, but they are
it
now.
Is. Yeah.
I can see Spotify breaking it. And the thing you said at the beginning, Jeremy, I thought was interesting was that if you're listening to audiobooks, you're not listening to music. And if you're listening to podcasts, you're not listening to music. So to some extent, they were cannibalizing their business. But equally, they're not going to convince people to listen to music instead of those things. And so up until now, if you decided to listen to audiobooks or podcasts, you were off their platform.
But as someone looking for music, am I more likely to keep... So I am a Spotify subscriber.
Well, okay.
Yep.
Am I more likely to give them money if they continue to invest in audiobooks and podcasts, which I don't listen to on their platform? Because eventually their music catalog is going to suffer.
Why? Probably. Why?
Because you can focus on one thing intently and three things less intently. If music is the only thing you do, you have to be great at it.
At least in theory, there's no reason why they couldn't have Spotify Music, Spotify Audiobooks, and Spotify Podcasts as three separate companies, which just happen to be in the same building, and the only point they have in common is a CEO at the top, right? Does Google Search suffer because they're building self-driving cars?
In a world with unlimited resources, I believe this theory, but then we have to come back to reality.
Yeah, but does Google Search suffer because they're working on self-driving cars? Maybe. Are you leaving for Bing?
Well, no, I would say I would argue the opposite. If your car's driving itself, that's more time for you to search. Like, in the end, the only thing that you're competing for with these all these platforms are your attention, which is hard capped at 24 hours, and that's if you don't sleep. So let's say it's really hard capped at 18 hours. Anything that it competes for your time is competing against each other.
Yeah, I agree.
Search and self-driving cars are not competing for your time. One's actually competing to give you more time.
By the way, very quickly, I actually pulled up the data. So this is just Baron Carter.
By the way, I can't believe you didn't say this. Released a new single, so go listen to the single. Plug your own stuff. Come on now.
Yeah. It's called Lethality. Go check it out.
We'll put it in the show notes
right now. Yeah, we will put it in the show notes, won't we?
Thank you, Jeremy, for the Lord Harry.
I think. Thank you, Jeremy, for we putting it in the show notes.
So now I have to spend my Thursday morning shilling for your band. I see how it works.
Yes, you do. Also, link to the pre-save link.
Put the links in the show notes, and I'll do it. If you don't do it, I don't have to.
So. All right, that's fair. I will do that.
So back to the numbers.
We bit of context. Been around for about a year and a half, three releases, all EPs, not full albums. Not a massively popular band. We have about 1,500 listeners a month on Spotify. I don't know about the rest. Like I say, Spotify takes
that
up most of it.
That seems all right.
Yeah, it's all right. And so in that time, the amount of money we've made on Spotify is $116.69. That's the highest.
In a year and a half.
That's in a year and a half, right?
Yeah.
Now, hang on. Let me find the next one. The next one is...
I wish I'd grabbed a screenshot of Jeremy doing the gangster handing out money thing. And I'd so much wish I could make it the screen picture for the poster.
The next one is
the
Apple. The next one is Apple iTunes.
Okay.
Which is at $32.49. And like I say, we have
Steep Cliff.
Way fewer people listening
to
Apple
iTunes.
Hang on,
but that's still streaming. It's not purchases. Or is that both?
I think that might be purchasing.
Oh, is this one of these things where it is both? You just haven't actually done any purchases.
Actually, I think that might be streaming because I think iTunes is where you buy it, right? And then it's broken down. iTunes is broken down by country. But next up is YouTube Music, astonishingly, at $30.56.
Really? Does anyone use YouTube Music?
Apparently so. And then next is iTunes UK.
Okay.
And then the next one is something called Quobuzz, which apparently is a French streaming service. What is this Quobuzz?
I can't wait till you saying I'm big in France now.
Wow. Yeah. This is like it's David Hasselhoff.
French commercial music streaming download. Yeah, we're huge in France. Huge is that's 14 bucks. So that's and then it breaks down
so
by
you
everything
are
else.
Grand. In France, well played.
Yeah. Oh, and Amazon Music. Actually, Amazon Music just is a little bit more at $17 than whatever it is.
See, the other thing that I thought was interesting is, and I don't know if this is the truth, but I can see someone at Spotify having thought of this, that sure, you've got musicians on board, but when you're dealing with musicians, you're not actually dealing with musicians. You are mostly dealing with the legal people at their massive record label. Whereas if you're dealing with podcasters, they're just some random people who basically don't even have any idea that they're being exploited half of the time and aren't going to argue back for a change in the contract that you have for them. And they have no actual market power because if someone at Parlophone decides they're going to leave, they take all of their artists with them. But a podcaster leaving, the whole point is you want everyone to be separate when you're dealing with them if you're Spotify, because then there's no collective bargaining power, right?
Right.
This doesn't apply to audiobooks because audiobooks are all published by existing publishers.
Yeah,
but it does apply to podcasts. So I feel like there's no comparison here, but I bet if you could measure contract fairness on some kind of absolute scale, the terms that published musicians get are better than the terms that podcasters get.
You don't think that the labels are arbitraging that difference and they, in the end, will be roughly the same?
I'm sure the same thing you get. If you're the guy with the guitar, then yeah, I agree with you. Probably the label gets a better deal. They then keep all the upside. And then what was Steve Albini's thing about having to swim down a ditch made of shit or something. He wrote just after he wrote an essay called The Problem with Music, or words to that effect, in like 1998. So this is the guy who he produced Nevermind for Nirvana and like a whole bunch of other stuff. And he wrote an article called, I believe it was called The Problem with Music, and it described the process of being in a band and what it was like. And where all the money went and who had it, for people who didn't know anything about this. So, Johnny, you probably knew all of this, but right. Most people didn't. And hearing a guy who actually knew about it, and he was describing the process of this person takes this cut, and this person takes this cut, and this person takes this cut, and how you get to go on tour, but then when you go on tour, you make all this money, but then you've got to pay for your tour bus, and you've got to pay for this, and you've got to pay for venues, you've got to do all that. And so you get to the end of the year, and yeah, you spent a year on tour, but you've actually only earned $11,000 that year. So you make the same amount of money as you would have done if you were working in a 7-Eleven. But you got to live on a tour bus for a year, so maybe that's a good enough trade-off. I mean,
perhaps, it's a lean life.
Perhaps when you're 21, maybe not so much now we're our age. But that was a really interesting, enlightening thing into this. And I wish someone would write that now.
Yeah, yeah.
For what it's like to be in a band these days, when your goal is not playing grotty pubs until some slightly less grotty A&R man scores you a deal.
You know what changed it for me was when I first moved to America and I set up my previous band, Severed Fifth. I got to know Chris Kontos, who played drums in Machine Head.
Yep.
And he helped the band out quite a bit and is a nice guy. Anyway, we were out one day and we were in like a pub or something like that. And he was telling us how to survive on the road. And he took us into the bathroom and he was showing us how you can buy a piece of like rubber tubing and stick it to the tap and shower yourself. And you have to look out for the particular type of like, you know, drain in certain bathrooms and gas stations. And that's how you shower yourself when you're on the road and how great it is. And I was thinking, that sounds fucking awful.
It's a Machine Head. They're a real band who people have heard of.
Yes. And he was telling us about like, you know, you get to clean your clothes every 4 or 5 days. You have one pair of stage clothes. And it's like, this is not happening.
This is like being a professional snooker player or something, right? The top 9 guys make loads of money and everyone else has this crap living doing exhibition shows in like working men's clubs or something.
Yes. Man, good times.
That's rough.
Wow, we've been gone for nearly an hour.
That was like the whole show. We did 2 things, I think, or 3.
I know, we had so much news. Maybe we can revisit some of our other news next time if it's not too old.
Yeah. Can talk about loads of stuff, but we haven't talked about any of it.
Wicked. All right. Well, as is always the case, let us know what you think, everybody, on our community. Go and check it out. And it's good to be back and chatting to you all. Anything that you guys want to share other than thanking the wonder and the power that is Marius Quarbeck before we drop off?
Nope. I was going to say we must thank Marius, our audio producer from nerdzoom.media, because he's cool and he does a lot of work. Cheers.
He does. And yeah, I think that's it, right?
We're good.
All right, fuck off.
See you soon.
See ya.
For reference, it is show 47, whoever's introducing.
Okay.
Okay.
Are we doing this in one wicked take?
I think so. We haven't got separate segments. So.
Yeah. Who wants the intro?
Jono.
All right.
Boom.
Show 47.
It's that easy.
Love the energy.
All right. There we go. It is. Fucking delegation right there.
Delegation. It's what you need.
All right.